So that's going to take up a bit of our time in the beginning here. I shouldn't have had a sandwich the size of that one. Let's just put it that way. Leave it there. Okay, so who are the Quakers? It's not that the settlement of Pennsylvania is going to be exclusively Quaker, but it's going to be heavily dominated by the Quakers, because the whole purpose of the settlement is very heavily skewed toward Quaker interests, and that initially the settlement of Pennsylvania would be a place that the Quakers can live in peace. And that's not to say they don't want other people to live there. They encourage other people, non-Quakers, to come live there. But the key idea is that there has to be some place on this earth where we can be not harassed. So the Quakers are at the center of this. So who are they? Well, it's generally taken to be the case that a guy named George Fox in England, a sort of religiously liberal thinker, in the mid-17th century, late 1640s, really was the founder of the Quakers. And the name Quaker comes from the idea that people ought to quake at the name of the Lord. That's where it comes from. Now, more or less, the Quakers believe essentially the following things. So you don't find a formal creed, a formal statement of Quaker belief, because the very issuing of such a statement would run counter to the whole Quaker package, which is precisely that they think that formal creeds and a lot of the formal structures of traditional religion are themselves stifling the religious life. And again, remember, on the questions, I'll take questions during the, you know, after we take a little break, and I'll go back and look at what you guys have asked. So submit the questions through the question form on the course page, and then I will get to them. But I'm too easily distracted, and I go off on too many tangents as it is. So I'll answer questions after. Okay, so no formal creeds. Simplicity and informality in dress, language, and worship. So in dress, a traditional Quaker anyway, you might look at him and say that he looks to you like somebody from the Amish. And in fact, I years ago, I guess, oh my gosh, 15 years ago, I spoke at the E.F. Schumacher Society Decentralist Conference at Williams College in Massachusetts. And I met for the first time a real live, I think his name was David Savage, and the last name was Savage, I remember that. And sure enough, he had the hat and the whole sort of thing, and he had taken a horse and buggy to get to the conference. He produced a magazine called Plain, P-L-A-I-N, like Plain Living. And I got a copy of it, and I noticed in there he was trying to raise funds so they could get a traditional old-timey printing press, so that he could do this in the most old-fashioned way possible. Now, most Quakers today, I think you won't find them, I guess the word actually shouldn't really be orthodox, quite so orthodox. Most of them won't go to quite this level. Perhaps in the same way that most Franciscans in the Catholic Church, most of them don't live quite the lifestyle of St. Francis of Assisi, of literally begging for your sustenance. And some do, but most of them don't. And likewise for the Quakers. But in language, what's meant there is the way their modes of address to people. So they would not refer to people using formal titles, regardless of how elevated somebody might be in the social or political hierarchy. They would refer to everybody in the same way, using words like thee and thou, which were considered to be very familiar words. And then in terms of worship, well, the Quakers were the height of informality in worship. So the Puritans thought different forms, depending on who's there, depending on, sometimes you would have somebody perhaps leading people in one way or another, or leading their meditations with certain suggestions. But other times it would be a matter of no one being in charge. And everybody, all the Quakers, would just sit there in the meeting. And as you were felt by the Spirit, you know, to move to speak, you would speak. But there could be times that no one felt moved to speak, and so people would just sit there in complete silence, and then everybody would go home. So you can't really improve on that in terms of simplicity of worship. They were pacifists. They believed in strict nonviolence. And we'll see that that's going to have political significance also. There's an emphasis in Quaker theology on what they call the inner light. So that is to say, the emphasis for the Quakers was placed not on external things. So as we've seen in their worship, there really were no externals. And it wasn't external doctrines or the ceremonies of worship or somebody preaching or these things that are external to the person that that was emphasized. Rather, it was the light that is within everyone, the divine spark that animates everyone. And it's basically, it's that that you want to draw on rather than sort of learning the religious sense from without. You learn it from within because it's the spark is already within you. And finally, they believe in religious toleration. Obviously, that's really just a corollary of pacifism. I mean, if you really take pacifism seriously, you're not going to initiate aggression. Well, then that shouldn't just mean I won't initiate aggression against people over this arbitrary boundary line, but I will initiate aggression against people who live in my own country. A strict pacifist would have to be strictly nonviolent in all cases, and so that would also lead to religious toleration. We'll see that that has political significance as well. Okay, that's a brief overview of who the Quakers are. I feel like I'm 6 years old again. We had one can of Hawaiian Punch that somehow gotten hidden in the back of the refrigerator. I dug it out just now, and man, I am enjoying that. Okay, now this is something that I did not go over the first week when we talked about the Puritans, because as you saw that week, I went 20 minutes over, as it was, and I like to save this for, like when I used to teach this in a classroom, I would save this stuff for when we talk about the Quakers, because it tells us something important about the Quakers. And that is the harassment, both that the Quakers perpetrated and suffered. When I say Quakers versus Puritans, what I have in mind particularly are some of the Quakers who were living in Rhode Island in the 1650s. Now, of course, you can understand why they would live in Rhode Island. Rhode Island was more or less a haven of religious liberty, certainly by colonial standards, and Massachusetts was not a particularly hospitable place for the Quakers. So the Quakers, even though, see, sometimes people hear the term religious toleration, and they conclude from this wimp, or they probably think all religions are the same. But that's not the same thing at all. You don't have to believe that all religions are the same. You know, like, you know, worshiping this remote control is just as good as any other religion. You don't have to believe that to believe in religious toleration. And the Quakers believed they were right. They weren't religiously tolerant because they thought, well, who's to say who's right in religious matters? You know, maybe you're right, maybe I'm right. We'll all just have to compete in the marketplace of ideas and see what happens. They believed they were right. So now that knowing that, we understand why they bothered the people in Massachusetts so much. They wanted to rouse them out of what they considered the torpor of, and just the dryness of Puritan worship and Puritan religion. They thought the Puritans were much too dour and pessimistic. Their theology was too pessimistic. The Quakers held out the possibility of universal salvation. So they did not believe that human beings were absolutely depraved. They had a much more optimistic outlook in that regard. So they would, as you can see on the screen here, but again, there are people who will be listening to this entirely in audio. So I just point out that these Quakers would make their way up to Massachusetts Bay, for example, and would disrupt the sermons. They would heckle the ministers and even at times walk up and down church aisles naked. You can imagine the effect this would have on a Puritan congregation. Who on God's green earth are these people? So naturally the Puritan response was a little bit harsh. The Puritans responded with whippings and sometimes, as we'll see, even worse forms of punishment, and yet the Quakers keep coming back for more. What the Puritans didn't get was that the Quakers in many cases almost yearned for the opportunity for martyrdom. So the more miserable you made it on them, the more they wanted to go up there. So the Puritans have no idea how to handle something like this. So I picked out, I mean, this Christopher Holder, we could choose almost at random from many cases of Quakers in Puritan communities. But so 1657, Christopher Holder and a companion received 30 stripes. They're imprisoned in a bare cell without proper bedding and without food or drink for 3 solid days. And then for the next 9 weeks, they're confined without any fire during a harsh New England winter, and they get a whipping twice each week, and the number of lashes they got increased by 3 with each whipping. All right, so you think, okay, well, once the 9 weeks are up, obviously Christopher Holder is going to go back to Rhode Island and we'll never hear from him again. To the contrary, he comes back the next year after safely returning to Rhode Island. He comes back the next year, goes to Dedham, Massachusetts, gets arrested in Dedham, is tried in Boston, convicted. They cut off one of his ears. And at that point, he disappears from the records of history. Nobody knows what happened to him. So, as I kind of hinted at before, as Massachusetts Bay increases the penalties against Quakers, they're inadvertently encouraging them all the more. And again, I don't know why all my blank lines aren't appearing here, because there is supposed to be a blank line between all the more and in 1658. In 1658, by one vote, the Puritan legislature, the Massachusetts legislature, actually votes for the death penalty for Quakers. Now, I want to share with you a little story, and it involves a woman named Mary Dyer from Newport, Rhode Island. And it's very interesting because her story gives us a sense of how uneasy the Puritans were in meting out some of these punishments, particularly against women. They really wanted to give Mary Dyer a chance. They gave her numerous chances to get away. They really did not. They felt very uncomfortable executing her. Okay, so Mary Dyer arrives in Boston in the early fall of 1659 with a couple of male companions, and they were banished on pain of death. She goes back, but only after having stayed in Rhode Island for a brief time, she returns once again to Boston. This time she's put on trial along with her male companions. And the next day, the governor announces the death sentence that is going to be meted out against them. And Mary Dyer replied, "The will of the Lord be done." And as she was taken away, she said, "Yea, joyfully shall I go." So a week later was the time that the three of them were set to be executed. So Mary Dyer marches to the gallows between the two young men who are condemned with her. And just to make sure she doesn't get to give like one last speech or any parting words, there are drums that are drowning out anything she might say. So she is, though, asked a question by a Massachusetts official: "Don't you feel shame walking publicly between these two young men?" And she answered that it is an hour of the greatest joy I can enjoy in this world. No eye can see, no ear can hear, no tongue can speak, no heart can understand the sweet incomes and refreshings of the Spirit of the Lord, which I now enjoy. So these two men are executed in front of her. And then Mary Dyer is mounted on the gallows, and her arms and legs are bound. And all of a sudden, at the very last minute, the Puritan authorities decide to give her a reprieve. And it turns out they had planned this in advance. They had known all along they were going to give her the reprieve, but they figured that if they scared her, you know, first they march her up there. If that doesn't scare her, they execute the two men. If that doesn't scare her, they put her up there. They try everything, and if she hasn't begged forgiveness, they'll just let her go, which indeed they did. So finally, Mary Dyer explains to the officials that she does not accept their reprieve unless they repeal the law against Quakers. I would rather die here on the spot. So they basically told her to go take a hike. They put her on a horse and sent her back to Rhode Island. But needless to say, she comes back. And she told a Quaker friend that I must go and win the repeal of that wicked law against God's people and offer up my life there. So less than a year after she's banished from the colony, now it's 1660, she returns to Boston. And once again, her sentence of death is repeated, but this time the governor says, "We are indeed going to carry it out." And as she's standing at the gallows, once again, they say, "Look, we will spare your life if you'll just get the heck out of here." But she says, "No, I cannot. in obedience to the will of the Lord God, I came here and in his orchard, and then just come back and keep doing, and be repeatedly willing to give your life. It says something about the intransigence of the Puritans, which I want to convey because I think the popular rendition of Quakerism gives the impression that these are cutesy little people you pat on the head, and aren't they sweet and cute? That's not only is that insulting to them, but it's totally misleading. I want you to get the sense, because later on tonight, I'm going to show you what the political consequences of this are and how unbelievably uncompromising and intransigent they are politically as well. This is really just an indication of that. Okay, let's see. All right. Okay, so the origins of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania meaning Penn's Woods, named after, it's actually not named after William Penn, it's named after William Penn's father, who was also named William Penn. His father, as Rothbard tells you, was owed, just in back salary and in money he had lent to the crown, he was owed a substantial sum, and then he died, and so his son, as I say, also named William Penn, in satisfaction for this debt, was granted title to what became the colony of Pennsylvania. And Penn, of course, he's the proprietor, and he can earn an income from this colony, but he really does have it foremost in his mind. Penn, of course, is a Quaker. He's a Quaker convert. I mean, well, pretty much everybody's a Quaker convert at that point because it was such a new faith, basically. But Penn wanted to establish a colony where the Quakers could live in peace, but also, as I said earlier, where religious toleration would be the rule, and they would encourage a diverse population. And that doesn't mean just religiously diverse, but also diverse nationalities. And we'll make note of that, there are Germans and Swedes and so on, Dutch. Okay, so Rothbard tells the story. It's quite astonishing, isn't it, of how resolutely anti-government the Pennsylvania settlers were. And he's trying to tie this into their Quaker beliefs. And I think he basically succeeds. I mean, if you really do take nonviolence seriously, then, you know, maybe you don't like the tax man. Maybe you don't like government officials quite so much. So once Penn leaves to go back to England, he's got other things to attend to, and he's concerned about stories he's hearing about a new wave of persecution of Quakers, and he wants to intervene on their behalf. So he leaves. The colony is established in the early 1680s. By 1684, Penn goes back to England. The government itself, now Rothbard goes through, as I told you from the start here, he's extremely detailed. I mean, he's going to tell you everything about everything. I don't want to go through exactly, you know, like initially the assembly didn't have the power to initiate legislation, but later it did. Here I want to just sort of just focus on how, you know, what the Pennsylvania government looked like when it really became codified in 1701. It was very fluid up to that point, but by 1701 with the Charter of Liberties, Pennsylvania Charter of Liberties, it's sort of set in stone. So you have a governor who can veto legislation. You have a council that's appointed by the governor. That council, as Rothbard says, used to be popularly elected, but now it's basically dominated by the governor. And then you have an assembly elected by the people with a modest property requirement. So you own a modest amount of property. You can vote in the assembly. There's no religious test, so there it's not like it's just a Quaker assembly. There are Quakers and non-Quakers in the assembly. But we notice that these various bodies don't really do anything. Now, initially, again, you don't have to keep track of all this technical stuff, but initially, it was only the council that could initiate legislation. So if the council doesn't meet, nothing gets done. The assembly can't initiate anything even if it wanted to. So the key thing, the key institution to focus on is the council at this time. And what Rothbard points out is that the council hardly meets at all for this four-year period while Penn's away. It hardly meets at all. And when it does meet, it doesn't really do anything. So this is, you know, Rothbard, of course, you can sense his excitement coming through the pages when he's telling you about this. And I'll tell you, by the way, I mean, I just got this new chair mat, and it's not quite working so well. anyway, you know, I studied colonial America at a fairly prestigious school, and I didn't learn anything about this. I didn't know anything about this until I read Rothbard. So, you know, there you go. All right, it's great. You don't have to be deprived of this. You go right to the source, the man himself, and look what you get. So this is basically stuff that you can read in Rothbard, but for any of you who didn't finish it or didn't quite get to it or whatever, just could use a little refresher, we'll just say quickly, William Penn gets word of this, that really no activity is going on. Nobody's voting any taxes. He had initially agreed to suspend taxation as a way of attracting settlers. But then they keep, you know, sort of extending this, and so finally he sends these vice commissioners of state in early 1687 to make sure the wheels of government are functioning. But these too are slow to take action. And in spring of 1688, when two bills are finally presented by these commissioners and the council, the assembly rejects both of them. And then, as Rothbard says, the colony kind of slips back into its initial, you know, more or less anarchist state. So finally, Penn winds up appointing a non-Quaker named John Blackwell as deputy governor, like basically to govern in his stead. Now go ahead, you know, go get the wheels of government moving here. So this brings us to this fascinating guy, Thomas Lloyd. Right, I mean, this is one of the gutsiest guys in colonial America, and that's saying something. All right, so Lloyd is president of the council. He holds something called the Great Seal. So the impress of the Great Seal, he argues, is necessary upon any order that's issued by an executive official. Otherwise, the order is invalid. So, when Blackwell tries to issue orders, Lloyd just simply refused to put the Great Seal on. So Blackwell can't get anything done. Gets extremely frustrated with this Thomas Lloyd, who also has a troublemaking brother. Blackwell, by the end, you can tell from reading Rothbard, he is just a defeated man by the end of his years in Pennsylvania. And he even says, look, I just can't. These people just have nothing of the principle of government in them. I mean, they won't listen. They don't want to do anything. They don't want to pay anything. There's no talking to these people. It's a story that about this, and yet, you know, they would bore you to death about every, you know, last detail of you know, every just whatever things that an antiquarian would be interested in, but nothing like this that had any life to it. Okay. So Blackwell finally, and again, I'm leaving a lot out, I mean, because there's no need to reproduce the whole Rothbard story, which is extremely interesting. But Blackwell tries to dismiss Lloyd and some of the other members of the council, and this leads to a big uproar among the assembly, and you don't have the right to do this. And so eventually, even William Penn finally comes down against Blackwell, who then serves out the remainder of his stay there, and he is hating every minute of it. He's obviously counting the minutes to get out of there. And finally, Blackwell is gone, and Penn is basically faced once again with the situation of how do I govern these people? They don't listen, they don't do anything, and so on and on. And Rothbard continues this story into the early 17th century. And there are so many interesting little side stories that take place of defiance of the government and things the government tries to do and people who resist and the Keithians and all this stuff. It's well worth reading, for sure. Now, I want to add to this, supplement this with a little bit of my own material. So, here, in fact, let me just double check if there's anything that I wanted to say else about the Quakers other than just this, because otherwise there's some other stuff I want to get into, because we are going to be kind of running out of time. I know that by the last few, I'll feel like I have so much to say that I'll say, gosh, I wish I'd gotten all this done earlier. Okay, that's all right. No, this is good. This is good. Okay, so the two things I want to focus on the first one might seem sort of minor, but again, I focus on it just to get as an indication of the the seriousness of the Quaker commitment. That, you know, it's not right to caricature them. They worked in deadly earnest on behalf of their principles. So one of them is involves the taking of oaths, which for the Quakers is an extremely serious thing because they believed that the Bible prohibited the taking of oaths. And so they took this to mean that it is a sin to take an oath. And I mean, the Quakers there are some parts of the Bible that perhaps there's a consistent interpretive framework for Quaker biblical studies. I mean, I know a fair amount about them, but not enough to know the answer to this question. But some parts of the Bible, I think that they interpret rather figuratively and as having a spiritual meaning only, and other parts they take quite literally. So they by and large take the Sermon on the Mount quite literally, and some of Christ's other instructions quite literally. And so in terms of oath-taking, they believe that there can't be any oath-taking. So they won't take oaths, and they also, as when they themselves are judges, they won't administer them either. So to this day, in Pennsylvania, as a kind of a remnant of Quaker times, you can make an affirmation instead of taking an oath. So, all right, so in colonial Pennsylvania, why would you have to take an oath? Well, if you hold office, you have to take an oath that you're going to be loyal to the King of England, and you have to take an oath, for example, as we would today, if you're serving on a jury, you have to swear that you're going to tell the truth. And if you're a judge, you would have to administer oaths to other people for these purposes. So the non-Quaker population of Pennsylvania begins to wonder, well, wait a minute, what's the matter with these bozos over here? Why won't they take oaths? I mean, how am I supposed to trust a Quaker witness who won't swear to tell the truth? Or, you know, what about officials who won't swear to be loyal to the British crown? Seems like kind of something a shill would say, but nevertheless, that kind of complaint was heard. Okay, click. Well, this goes back and forth for a very long time. And finally, Britain thinks it has arranged a suitable compromise. So the Quakers can take an affirmation. They can say that they solemnly affirm to tell the truth or whatever. However, Quakers, if they are going to serve in the office of judge, they have to administer oaths to people who wish to take them. Okay, well, some Quakers went along with this compromise. But interestingly, by and large, the Quakers resisted even this. And so the result was mass resignations of judges from courts in colonial Pennsylvania. And also, we see some of the Quaker meetings urging their co-religionists not to vote for their fellow Quakers for political office. Don't vote for our own people, basically, because if they win, they might be tempted to take the oath. And we don't want to put them in that perilous spiritual condition, so don't vote for them in the first place. And from the Quaker point of view, they had won a great victory because they had shown that regardless of the temptation, they had stuck to their principles. Okay, but I guess by that standard, it is a victory. But one might well ask, it seems a kind of an oddball kind of victory if it means that the victory means no Quaker can be a judge in the colony now. Like, no Quaker is going to serve as a judge, but to them, that's a great victory because at least we didn't compromise on our principles. Now, the more important issue involves the question of pacifism. Because how can a people that does not believe in violence, I almost said, because I'm so attuned to libertarianism, I almost said they don't believe in the initiation of violence. But that's not correct. Because they go beyond the libertarian creed, which would say, you know, you can't initiate aggression against a peaceful person. But they're even going to argue that you can't push back. You can't resist violently. So, in fact, I think there actually is a Simpsons episode in which Homer is with the Amish, and he's, I don't know, like he's slapping some guy or punching him or whatever and saying, look, Marge, they don't fight back. And then I think a donkey comes over and kicks him in the head, and so he gets his comeuppance. But the question becomes, how can they serve? Wouldn't there be demands that at some point you've got to do something? You've got to supply a militia. You've got to do something. So this issue really sort of comes to the fore in the 1740s, early 1740s, really 1739, and into the 1740s, because there Britain is at war with France and Spain. Now, obviously, when the mother country's at war, all of her possessions are fair game for her military opponents. So that means that anytime the British are at war, that drags the colonies in. And the concern here was, this began as something called the War of Jenkins' Ear, and ultimately the War of the Austrian Succession is taking place. And so now the colony is faced with some difficulties, because on the Delaware River, there are Spanish privateers. So there's a chance that they could be attacked. What are the Quakers going to do? Well, they manage to stall for time for a while. They create gridlock in the assembly, so to speak. But then finally, after stalling and buying some time, in 1745, the assembly makes an appropriation for bread, beef, pork, flour, wheat, or other grain for the garrison they have. Now, other grain, some people took to mean gunpowder. They were sort of very, very indirectly, a very cagey kind of way, evading their pacifist principles. Well, it's hard to say. But the real significance of this episode in the 1740s is the emergence of a compromise party led by Benjamin Franklin. Now, Franklin, of course, was not a native of Pennsylvania. He had been born in Boston in 1706. He was the son of a candle maker and soap maker. But he goes to Philadelphia, which is a flourishing merchant center, a mercantile center. I mean, maybe the wealthiest city in colonial America. By the time he's age 24, he already owns a print shop where he edits and publishes the Pennsylvania Gazette. And at age 27, he first brought out Poor Richard's Almanac. So he retires from business. This is just a brief digression about his background on Benjamin Franklin. After retiring from business at age 42, he had, among other things, founded a library, set up a fire company, helped start the Academy, which became later the University of Pennsylvania, an Ivy League institution, and he also had started a debating club, which later grew into the American Philosophical Society. He wrote Experiments and Observations on Electricity in 1751, which was translated into numerous languages. He had invented the lightning rod. He invented a glass harmonica for which Beethoven and Mozart composed. In his travels as a colonial agent to London and later as American ambassador to France, he developed suggestions, some of which were later adopted, for ship design. So, you know, he's a fairly illustrious guy. Now, Rothbard thinks relatively little of Franklin, I think, because of, you know, he does have some sleazy elements, and I think he may not have treated women as respectfully as perhaps he ought. And also that for at least a time, Franklin was in favor of the issuing of paper money in Pennsylvania. You can imagine what Rothbard would think of that. And it turns out that one of the main motivating factors behind his support for paper money and the writings that he composed on behalf of paper money was that his print shop was going to get the contract to print the money. I mean, come on! That is one of the great things about reading Rothbard, by the way, is that he is not interested just in what did the person say about his motives. He wants to know who this guy worked for, who is he related to, what line of work is he in, is there a chance that the thing he's advocating the government do might in fact redound to his own material benefit. I mean, he asks these sorts of questions that other historians would be appalled at the cynicism, but it seems to me that a good investigative historian needs to ask questions like that. So anyway, that's just a little bit of a digression about Franklin. He's a very interesting guy. But so the most significant outcome of this controversy from the 1740s is the emergence of Franklin. And his view that there needs to be some kind of compromise. Because he wanted to take the position that he was not pro-Quaker and he was not anti-Quaker per se. Okay, let's move along here. So he publishes a pamphlet in 1747 called Plain Truth. So up to that time, Pennsylvania had been relying on the length and difficulty of its bay to protect itself against invaders. But now, Franklin was arguing, a more robust approach was called for. And so his argument is that it's the plain truth of the matter, and the reason for titling the pamphlet this, is that if government has any function at all, it is at the most fundamental level to protect the people against aggression. And no religious scruple can be permitted to override that fundamental obligation. So, the Quakers, well, they have a religious scruple about using defensive force. So what he's more or less saying here is that, well, if it so happens that you do have such a religious scruple, then maybe government is not for you. Maybe this is not the right line of work for you. Maybe you should step down and basically let the grown-ups take over, was essentially what he was saying. You know, let the people who are going to be serious about the situation take over and provide this necessary service to the people of the colony. And oh gosh, I'm sorry, to allow others to take control of the colon. Well, I don't know, I'm sure there's a great joke there, but I'm thinking about my sandwich, but no, of course I should be colony. I'm sorry, it's my failing eyesight once again. So Franklin winds up proposing a plan for a privately funded defense, and soon a 10,000-man militia is established. And you think, by the way, doesn't that solve the problem? Like, haven't you fixed it? But, well, not everyone feels that way. Okay, well, now, you know, the you-know-what is really going to hit the you-know-what. But, well, I suppose I could say fan. So 1755, now we have this big problem. One of the things Rothbard points out is that the Quakers, beginning with the example of William Penn, who was a real model in this regard, it had very friendly relations with the Indians. And the Delawares were perhaps the most significant. And there had never been one drop of Quaker blood shed by the Indians, not once. And Rothbard even points out that the Quakers thought nothing of even leaving their children in the care of the Indians. I mean, that was how good the relationship was. So, and then there's that funny Voltaire quotation, because of course the Quakers don't believe in oaths, that the agreements between the Quakers and the Indians was the only agreement between whites and Indians that was never sworn to and never broken. Well, in 1755, we have a major problem brewing, because along the colony's western border, and there were a lot of the non-Quakers, actually, there were a lot of non-Quakers who lived out on the western border of the colony, and particularly German Lutherans, a lot of them lived out there. They were complaining that terrible massacres at the hands of the Delawares were taking place. And so maybe the thing to do is to go back and review our trading practices with the Indians to make sure that nobody's taking advantage of them and that there isn't any source of complaint they might have against us that might lie there. Well, again, this is not what people are interested in hearing at that time. So again, Benjamin Franklin intervenes and says, you know, I'm not against a more just Indian policy, as the Quakers are calling for here. But in the immediate run, some provision for military defense has to be made. But the Quakers who controlled the assembly would not budge. And at the same time, entire towns were abandoned in the wake of the ongoing massacres. I mean, people's homes were being burned to the ground. Women and children were being carried off. People were being killed. It was a bad situation, regardless of the right or wrong of it, which is something that we may never really know the full answer to. But in other words, the Quaker response was not going to satisfy the victims of these attacks. So the obvious question that now presents itself to the Quakers is it going to be possible for us in the last resort here to hold on, to maintain political power but and also maintain our principles. Instead of backing down and violating them, violating our pacifist principles. Okay, let's move on. So by, let me just take one last, sorry, let's delete this. By 1756, Quakers actually begin to resign from the assembly rather than abandon their principles. And one thing that I think pushed them over the edge into that decision was that the British Crown had gotten word of these massacres and of the fact that the Quakers in the assembly were hesitating to authorize some serious measure of military defense. And the Crown's horrified response was that if some provision is not made for defense, then the Quakers, you know, forget about that. Forget about them. They're not going to be allowed to take part in government anymore. They're going to be disqualified from holding political office. So they were advised, but particularly Quakers back in England were advising Quakers in Pennsylvania, stick to your principles. Don't be railroaded into doing something you don't believe in. And perhaps the thing to do is indeed to resign, so that perhaps two things could happen. One would be if you resign now, it would still be possible to shift some of the blame for the violence onto whoever it is who takes over from you. And secondly, the thought was, well, we resign now. Whoever replaces us may indeed be able to perhaps take care of the situation, perhaps the problem will go away, and then later in the future, once sort of the coast is clear, so to speak, we can return to government once again. Well, as it turns out, that was not to be. They did not return to political office after this incident, after this sort of mass resignation, in any significant numbers at all. But, you know, I think a lot of us who are listening to me now would agree that just because you're not serving in government does not mean that your life is worthless. That is not the only thing you can do. And in fact, the Quakers became known for their heroic labors on behalf of ending slavery and the slave trade, of humanizing prisons and insane asylums. I mean, if you could see what the treatment of the insane was like. Now, okay, I mean, I understand, I know that the Thomas Zaz thing, but the point is they did have asylums, and they were the most inhumane places you can imagine, and the Quakers were leading crusades against that sort of treatment of human beings, and also the building of hospitals, so they went on to distinguish themselves in these great and important humanitarian causes. But what they had indeed done, though, was established the principle, and indeed also the practice, of an American colony that was established from the beginning officially as a place of a religious toleration and of diversity from the point of view of nationality. And indeed, it flourished and prospered. And as I say, its city, Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia, was arguably the richest city in colonial America and certainly one of the most, if not the most, influential such city. Okay. So I think I will, I like to go between 45 minutes and an hour, so I think we'll pause there. What was Benjamin Franklin's religion? As far as I can tell, he was a deist. And I mean, we see there's some reflection of that in his autobiography. So autobiography is kind of funny, you know, interesting. Like he had a correspondence with a friend of his, and they had this agreement that whichever one of them was the first to die, if there really was an afterlife, then that person would appear to the, it would come as a ghost and tell the other one, yes, yes, there's an afterlife and I'm a ghost in it. And I guess his friend died first and he never heard from him. So I don't know. And then I like his 13 steps, you know, if you want to, for self-improvement, you know, because you get through the first few of them, you think, all right, I could do this, you know, get up early and work and all that. And then, you know, and it gets a little harder and harder. You think, all right, but if I really applied myself, maybe I could do this. And then step number 13 is imitate Jesus and Socrates. Okay. Well, I'll just get right on that. Okay. Let's see what else we got here. Okay. Thank you, Brian. I don't know, everybody tries to lobby John Stewart. I just don't think it works, but thank you. Let's see. Yeah, I just don't see how the zombie fits in with rollback. I'm not sure. Maybe it could. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people don't know what nullification is. Yeah, that's true, but I'm doing everything I can to get the word out about that. Autographed copy. Well, you buy yourself one and send it to me, and I'll be glad to sign it. Okay. Yeah, that Nozick ending, it's kind of out of place in the book, frankly, but I wanted to force it in. Thought of reading your own book. They don't really let you read your own books. Mainly, I think, because every author in the world thinks he would do a great job reading his books. But it's harder than you think, because, you know, unless you're a really good speaker, you're going to, you know, have some ums and ahs, and you're going to hesitate. They're going to have to stop the recording and start it up again. But these professional readers, even though they're as boring as can be, they know what they're doing. They articulate well. They read at a good pace. They read accurately. They don't make mistakes. Whereas they've heard a million times authors, oh, I'd be great at reading my book, and it's like a 58-hour ordeal, and I think they just don't want to do it. I did read my book on the liturgy, Catholic liturgy, but that's kind of an obscure title. Okay. Yeah, I'm sure I could adapt the zombie to rollback, but I don't think this sequel would really work, because it's, I just don't think it would, I don't think it really works. Any Quakers involved in the fighting in the American Revolution? Well, by and large, what the Quakers would do during wartime was they would provide medical care for the sick. And they, in fact, the Quakers actually won the Nobel Peace Prize, I think, in the 20th century for some of their humanitarian work, helping the suffering and the wounded and so on during the war. So that's how they would contribute to wars. The Quaker belief is reminiscent of Anne Hutchinson. Yeah, Dennis, I'll get to that when we get to the formal question. Oh, yeah, I think I'm over the... That was more than a 10-minute break, wasn't it? Okay. Sorry about that. All right. But let me take these last ones that are sitting here. I'll do those, and then I'll go to the formal questions, because as long as you've got it. I don't have any... Well, on Murphy's Krugman Challenge, and there's been no movement on it, but I know Bob intends to do some more vigorous promotion of it in 2011, but he's just got a lot on his plate right now, and his schedule is just impossible. Let's see. Okay. Anyway, let's see. Oh, wait, hold on. We were on the Beck Extreme? I didn't see that. So I'd love to hear what we were saying. I didn't know about that. Oh, and okay, so somebody answered the question, what is zombie? Somebody put a YouTube link so you can watch that. There's an even fuller thing about it at right here. Look at this. Can you believe I did this? Can you believe this? There. Can you believe I bought that? Okay, let's see. All right, somebody's asking about Thomas Lloyd's background. I just flip back into Rothbard to answer that. I don't know. I just, other than he's a Quaker, I don't know anything else about him. Okay. You know, Beast Vampire. But nullification, the book of the concept. That's good. Thank you. Ben Franklin was a spy. I don't have any insight on that. There might be other quirky laws that go back to the Quakers. I mean, the one about affirmations is the only one I'm familiar with. I've read Scarlet Letter and Moby Dick, but it's been so long since I read them that I just wouldn't be able to comment on their portrayal of these. I mean, we're talking about like junior high school and high school. Oh yeah, I remember we read Moby Dick in junior year of high school. We read 50 pages a night of Moby Dick, and we thought this was like the most inhuman thing we had ever seen. She's making us read 50 pages a night. Okay. Oh, okay, wait, by the way, here's a little quiz for you. We've had two U.S. presidents who, well, we've had one U.S. president who described himself as a Quaker, and another one who had a Quaker grandmother. Anybody know who they are? Yeah, the Zombie Blooper YouTube is also at interviewwithazombie.com. Nixon is the one with the Quaker grandmother. And that's good. You guys are good. That's right. So who's the Quaker? I don't think John Tyler. I'll give you a hint. It's 20th century. And it's not Carter. I'll keep looking and see. Hoover is correct. Hoover is correct. That is right. That is right. Okay. All right. Now let's go to... Oh, yeah, conscientious objector. Yeah, sure, but that's not just a Pennsylvania law. The question was, are there specifically Pennsylvania laws? Okay. Let's go to the questions, and I'm going to do open in a new window, put the questions side by side with you guys. If this window would move, there we go. All right. And I'm going to refresh the questions if any others were added. Okay. Okay. Refresh. Oh, right. Okay, I'm going from the bottom. And then the American Revolution thing, I would say that if they were fighting in the American Revolution, they would not have been very good Quakers. But that's why I gave that little overview of what the Quakers have actually done over the years when it comes to war. They've basically done the best they can to alleviate the human suffering that follows from war, and they view that as being their contribution. Where did the Great Seal come from? I don't know. I had never heard about the Great Seal until I read Conceived in Liberty, so I honestly don't know. In all my studies of colonial Pennsylvania, so I don't know. The Quaker belief in an inner light is reminiscent of Anne Hutchinson. Do believers in an inner light tend towards a libertarian philosophy more than those who favor other more formal worship and theology? It seems like that should be the case. Like, you can understand why that would be the case, right? I mean, if you believe in some kind of, if you believe in an inner light, then, you know, why should I listen to this clergyman or this politician? You know, I mean, forget that. I got this inner light. So you'd think that. I'm not sure it works out that neatly. I'm just thinking out loud here, because the Quakers, yeah, I mean, I don't know if they've actually been libertarians. I mean, really what they've more or less been is they've tried to disengage from the surrounding society more than openly defying it, using libertarian ideology. But there could be something there. But at the same time, there's enough in traditional Christian belief that, you know, the emphasis on the value of the individual soul, and the implied sense basically it would be that, and Christ's nonviolent example, and that, you know, there is no scriptural injunction that says, you know, make sure and go do good things by taking people's stuff and doing good with it. No, what it actually says is, you know, you should not do evil that good may come. So I mean, you can draw libertarian themes out of any of it, but maybe there is something to that inner light thing. I don't know. I really have to think that over. I'm not sure it follows, but it sounds good to me, but I'm just not sure about it. Okay, so we have not mentioned Quaker consensus. Why didn't it ever influence Pennsylvania state government? I think the main reason for that is that there were too many non-Quakers in the assembly. And I don't think they thought this way. I think their view was, I just want to get the maximum number of votes. I don't care about creating consensus. For people who want to know about Quaker consensus, let me me call something else, see if I can find a link here. All right, I think maybe this gives a sense of it. All right, well, okay, so I've just called up a link here explaining what this is. I'm going to put it right here. Bang. Okay, that's what I'm looking at right now. Following aspects of the Quaker model are an adaptation. Oh, because there's a college that has sort of adapted the idea of Quaker consensus. Multiple concerns and information are shared until the sense of the group is clear. Discussion involves active listening and sharing information. Norms limit the number of times one asks to speak to ensure that each speaker is fully heard. Ideas and solutions belong to the group. No names are recorded. Differences are resolved by discussion. The facilitator identifies areas of agreement and names disagreements to push discussion deeper. The facilitator articulates the sense of the discussion, asks if there are other concerns, and proposes a minute of the decision. The group as a whole is responsible for the decision, and the decision belongs to the group. The facilitator can discern if one who is not uniting with the decision is acting without concern for the group or in selfish interest. Dissenters' perspectives are embraced. The goal is unity, not unanimity. I don't know. I think I would need to see. Maybe this is not the best. Because something about this seems slightly creepy to me. I mean, I think when the Quakers did it, it would be one thing, because everybody shares the same philosophical grounding. But I think if you were to try to impose this version anyway on a really diverse group of people, I think it would almost inevitably turn into bullying. But, yeah, exactly. There is kind of something Orwellian about at least that rendering of it. Maybe I'm not doing it justice with that. It's just that was the juiciest link that popped up. Are there any specific... this question about the living standards of Pennsylvania. I'm sure there is a source on this for the colonial period. Of course, any kind of economic statistics in the 17th century, 17th and 18th centuries, are going to be hopelessly sketchy, because even the 19th century statistics we have on employment patterns and employment figures and stuff are extremely unreliable. So really you're relying on a kind of accumulation of anecdotal evidence. And the anecdotal evidence is just overwhelming. This was a prosperous settlement. It was never wanting for settlers. And I also mentioned the success of the city of Philadelphia. Okay. Okay, can't assess the time of discussions we had this class. Truly understand the family. This is why it's not taught in school. It doesn't fit the mold. You disagree. Well, I think the key, there are a variety of different ways that it's valuable to know about the colonial period. I mean, for one thing, did you notice in there that, Delaware is one of the original 13 colonies. Nobody thinks of Delaware when you think of the original 13. Nobody thinks of Georgia as being one of the original 13, but they were. But Delaware, you discover reading this, it had the same governor as Pennsylvania, but it actually became independent Delaware through an act of secession. I mean, it seceded from Pennsylvania. That's just an interesting little thing. So nobody said, oh my gosh, one entity splitting into two? This is the end of the world. I mean, this is, the world's going to catch fire or something. It just happened. It's just funny to see, it's fun to read just little tidbits like this. Also, though, it's interesting to note how different the colonies are from each other. Quaker Pennsylvania is not at all like Puritan Massachusetts, which is not at all like Anglican Virginia. And so that, now obviously as time goes on, Pennsylvania becomes less, the Quaker imprint is less robustly felt. The Puritan imprint is less clearly felt in Massachusetts, but still, Massachusetts continues to have a state-funded church establishment all the way until 1833. There clearly are regional and colonial differences that persist into the time of the American War for Independence. And so this does help us understand the founding in the sense that, at least when we get the Constitution, why the First Amendment is written the way it is. It doesn't say the federal government has the power to abolish all religious establishments in all the states. What it says is Congress shall make no law. It says the federal government shall take a completely non-interventionist approach to this issue. It does not grant power to the federal government. It limits the federal government's power. Well, now we understand why. Because the colonies are so different from each other, and then later they become states, that none of them wants any other one to have so much power to be able to forge the other colonies and other states into their image. So, you know, we learn this by looking at the colonial period. We see various statements and declarations of rights that are drawn up. So we see the centrality of that. We see the jealousy with which the colonies guarded their independence. And we'll note, beginning next week and to the one after, for example, in the 1650s, Massachusetts asserted a veto in something called the Confederation of New England, which was a confederation of New England settlements that banded together for purpose of defense against Indian attacks. And Massachusetts felt that some of them were engaged in offensive measures, and it didn't want to be dragged into an offensive war, and so it lobbied for a veto power over decisions of the Confederation. So again, there's an emphasis on our colony needs to have the final say. When in the second half of the 17th century, the British Crown establishes the Dominion of New England that brings a lot of the colonies together, not just the ones we think of as New England today, but also New York and Pennsylvania, and threatening to bring others in as well, and suspending all their legislatures and ruling it through one royal governor. Well, what do you think the response to that is? Naturally, outrage. We want our powers of self-government back. When Benjamin Franklin in the 1750s proposes the Albany Plan of Union, bringing the colonies together, he doesn't get any support for that at all. So what does this all show us? That self-government is at the heart of the American experience. And so it's through this lens that we understand later developments like the Constitution. All this stuff comes from studying the colonial period. Okay, let's refresh, and if no other questions, I will go back to the chat window. Okay, let's see. So did the anarchy work well? Because they were Quakers. Okay, so the question is, did the anarchy work well, mostly because they were Quaker, who were moderated by their religious beliefs, as opposed to anarchy successfully occurring in a more multicultural atmosphere that exists today in the U.S., Canada, and Europe? Well, I think that I think it helped in the sense that I think also states may, in fact, work better in conditions like this. People always say, people talk about the fact that culturally there is a lot of homogeneity in the Scandinavian countries, and that's why their welfare states work better. Well, I'm not sure I buy that, but it strikes enough people as plausible that they at least advance it. I think it is possible, because I think that when you have, like, for example, when the U.S. has provided foreign aid to a lot of countries, in countries where there's a lot of ethnic diversity, this becomes a source of contention. Well, our group is getting shafted in the distribution of the aid, the aid money, and then this becomes a source of contention and fighting and bitterness, and there would be one less source of that if you had just a bunch of Quakers getting some aid somewhere. So on those grounds, you could say that. I think that's largely, in good measure, the explanation. They genuinely did not want to lord it over each other, and they could more or less function, and they shared a common worldview. At the same time, though, there are plenty of non-Quaker settlers. You know, we have to bear that in mind, and more as time goes on, and somehow it seemed to work. Now, of course, remember what Rothbard's perspective is. I mean, you know, Rothbard is excited about this because he himself is a private property anarchist. I mean, obviously not the left-wing variety, but the private. His view is that the state is not morally legitimate because it's exercising a coercive monopoly, and it's involved in the expropriation of people and the initiation of aggression against innocent people, and that's not morally acceptable. The state is not morally acceptable, and moreover, every function the state performs can be and has been performed by entrepreneurs and in the private sector, and even things as difficult as law. Well, you know, law, we have the example of merchant law developing in the Middle Ages. You had merchants all over the world, and there is no world government to allow adjudication between them, so how do they work this out? They develop their own law, just develops spontaneously, privately, through the course of, you know, accumulated decisions and their interactions with each other. So anyway, so of course, Rothbard's view would be that this could indeed work everywhere. Now, of course, one may dispute that. We can argue this, but I'm just telling you that's what his position is. That's what he argues in his books. That it's not simply that the state is, you know, 85% unnecessary or they're lying to you 90% of the time, but 10% of the time they're totally indispensable. His view is no, they're lying and quite dispensable 100% of the time. Okay, let's see. Do we have any others? Okay, that's the last one I got. So let me turn my head over here to the chat window, and we'll keep on trucking for a little while here and see if there are things other than, I mean, if you have other course questions, by all means ask them. Otherwise, if you just want to talk about whatever, we could do that also. Let's see. Now, on this thing, this statement, though, war almost always accompanies attempts at secession. I don't know if that's the case. The Soviet republics seceded from the Soviet Union peacefully. Slovenia seceded peacefully from Yugoslavia. What was the one of the Scandinavian countries? And I can't think of. Was it Norway that seceded in early 18th century? I can't remember. It was Norway. Yes, seceded from Sweden. Right. Okay. So, I mean, I think there are cases of this. So I don't think that's necessarily so. Okay. Yeah, boy, George, that's a really, really great point. Yeah. That is exactly Nisbet's view. And that was the view, it's been a view of a lot of people, that certain types of individualism can, in fact, lead to more state control. Because what Nisbet argues in The Quest for Community is that these large centralized states, by smashing people's sources of identity, these smaller associations that they smashed, didn't replace that with anything other than membership in the large centralized state. And so this kind of fills this spiritual vacuum of people, that the one source of identity they now have is I'm an American or I'm a Frenchman, and that becomes the most important thing to them, and this makes them less anxious to limit the power of the thing that gives them their identity. Okay. Yeah, the economics in one. Yeah, I mean, really, I mean, I know what the Keynesians are saying when they say, you know, destruction can lead to prosperity, because their argument is that the, you know, in a recession, resources are idle, labor's idle, capital equipment is idle, factories are idle, so it would help to get these things churning again. That's what they're saying. So they would say that if we weren't in a recession and then there was destruction, well, yeah, anything we did to rebuild would just be taking away from some other worthy project, and it would just be a wash, and we agree with that. But what they're saying is that right now all this stuff is sitting there idle, and so we would just get it going, and that would give a jump start to things. But I want to give you guys the reply to that. I'm gonna put the link in here. And as usual, it's an article by Bob Murphy. Is there any question of value to mankind that has not been definitively answered by Bob Murphy? Because if so, I haven't found it. There you go. Okay, have I heard any more about Dr. Paul's thought regarding running for president in 2012? No, I haven't heard anything. And I haven't been at any events that he's been at. since, in fact, I don't know, when was the last time we were at the same, oh, CPAC, okay, yeah, but, I mean, I didn't really, I mean, it was so, everybody's schedule was so insane at that event, I didn't get to speak to him privately or anything, I just spoke to him on the stage, and before that, I'm not being a name dropper, I'm sorry, somebody asked, but I had talked to him on the phone, but that was New Year's Day. Last time was New Year's Day, and obviously I shouldn't really repeat what was said in that conversation. But I will at least say that he did seem to me to be sincerely saying that at least at that time he was genuinely still not decided. He was not just playing games with people. He genuinely had some things to think about, and he genuinely wanted to see the depth of the support out there. Okay. Demonstrate that we have to convince the entire world in order for such a society to exist in a few years. Nathaniel, not necessarily. I think you would just have to convince enough people in the society it wasn't that the Quaker experiment was ruined because foreign invaders came in. But I mean, I don't know if it can ever really come into it. I mean, it would require an unbelievable educational effort. But, you know, who knows? Who knows? There are a lot of things that have happened in world history that you wouldn't have expected. Okay, it reads Jeff Tucker's piece today. No, I haven't read Jeff Tucker's piece today. Okay, let's see. It's my question above. I'm sorry, I didn't see your question. Okay, sorry, I will go back and look at your question. Okay, can you, just for one second, because people not comment, because otherwise it'll push me away and I won't be able to read it. So just hang on just one second. Hold all your brilliant thoughts for one moment while I get this question that I missed. Okay, wait, hold on. Keep going. Okay, I see a lot of comments. I don't see the question. Again, this could be my eyesight, but... okay, I got it. Hold on. I was under the impression that pacifists throughout history were aware that participation goes critical. This put forward. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm actually not so sure about this, because I think if you ask the typical pacifist, like, for example, I did a book on called We Who Dared to Say No to War, and it's a collection of some of the most interesting anti-war stuff that my co-editor and I could find from all the major American wars. Now, my co-editor calls himself a pacifist, and he genuinely believes in pacifism, and he has been involved in Jewish pacifist circles for a very, very long time. He's 80 years old now. But he also believes in, you know, the minimum wage and antitrust laws and whatever, and he sees no incompatibility in that. I think because he doesn't... I think he thinks of... I don't think he's just thought the whole thing through, the radical implications of his position. You know, Butler Schaefer is very good on this, showing that, indeed, most pacifists don't draw out the full implications of their position. They just think, I'm against initiating aggression against aggressors. But we've all been raised to think that government is a bunch of public servants trying to provide for the public good. I mean, this is what everybody has been taught since the beginning of time. So it's very easy, I think, not to see a possible, or not just a possible, a clear contradiction there. Let's see. Albert, no, okay. Waited. This other stuff is wonderful. What do I think about Gary Johnson? Yeah. Well, I know some people, people are kind of seem to have mixed feelings about Gary Johnson. I basically like him. I mean, I understand, you know, he's not, some of the arguments he makes aren't the kinds of arguments I would make, but they lead to the same outcome. And he does say some things, you know, about making government more efficient that, you know, kind of make me shudder from time to time. But at the same time, though, I think it has to be acknowledged. I think he is, I think he is a courageous person. I think he's taken courageous positions on important issues. And, I mean, the fact that, you know, he's gone to one or two of these Nullify Now events and used the word nullification in his speech. I mean, that's, you know, how many people would do that? It's a very rare thing. And, I mean, look, there are people I know personally whom I do not like. So it's not just a matter of, because I do know him a little bit, therefore I have to say I like him. I know some creeps, and I've said that I don't like them. But the fact that he's been very nice to me and generous with me, and, you know, when we were on that panel together at Freedom Fest last year, he was very friendly. And, you know, whereas usually that crowd, the crowd that seems to like him the most, they tend to be the ones that want to keep me at arm's length. So that kind of made me think that he's an independent thinker. You know, he's not going to be boxed in by, you know, some guy telling him, hey, you're allowed to like this guy, not like that guy. So I think all these things speak well for him. So anyway, I mean, I like him anyway. Okay, let me go back and look again. I'm looking at the questions you guys have. Okay, in the present day, what would happen if one state seceded from the Union? Can I let him know that the audio stinks in his... Yeah, they all know that, but there's nothing he could do. That's been true for all the chairmen and all the hearings. It's the stupid government. So you have to wait for the YouTube when somebody amplifies the sound, which is now they've got it. Now you can go online, and there is a YouTube of that whole hearing with the sound so that you can hear it, and it really is worth hearing. Salerno and Grant and Lehrman were absolutely excellent. I mean, they could not have been better. But yeah, I actually sent a note over to his office and found out that basically there's nothing you can do. What would happen with a... I read the Bob Wenzel response, and, you know, I see his points. I mean, I understand where he's coming from, but I think I have my arguments are sort of mitigating factors here. Let me go back. I just forgot a question. Does Vaughn know? No, Vaughn is only writing about he's only writing about the Puritans. Vaughn's book is New England Frontier. Yeah, it's just a book about New England, so Vaughn doesn't talk about Lloyd. Let me go back a bit. Okay, everybody just hang on just 1 second. Okay, just don't type anything in yet, so just hang on a second. What would happen if one state... See, well, this is entirely hypothetical. Like, there's no way to know. It just seems unlikely that they would... I don't think it's likely that we'll see secession in our lifetimes. I could be wrong about this. It's just been too demonized. It's too, you know, anybody who even mentions it is put on the hate list, and, you know, even and accused of being haters, whereas when the establishment puts you on the hate list, it just means they hate you. It doesn't mean you hate anybody. I don't hate anybody. So I don't think it's going to, but if it did, I mean, how are they going to justify using violence? Really, how are they going to justify that? I mean, in the eyes of the world, using violence because, you know, Vermont thinks it would be better off without Walmart, and they want to be free to do that. I mean, could you really morally justify carpet bombing Vermont? I just don't think you could get away with it. Okay, let me look again here. What else you got? Guys, hang on with the entering stuff. Let me just read this. Okay, you can respond to claims. You got the test. Go away. Okay, so the question involves my view of Puritan-Indian relations, which really comes from Vaughn and from some scholarly articles that I read. Could I respond to the claim that, you know, the white man devastated the Indians with diseases, tyranny, whatever? Well, okay, I think a lot of the American experience does involve betrayal of the Indians, so I don't want to, you know, make it seem like I don't believe that. I think a lot of it does involve that. So, you know, and aggression against them. So, I mean, that I don't think that can be denied. We shouldn't try to deny that. And in terms of diseases, well, it's not the Europeans' fault. A disease is non-volitional. So it's not, again, that's something you can freely concede. It's not, It's not something they intended to do. But in a way, and I hope this won't sound perverse, but oddly enough, this is one way in which Western civilization, which, like every civilization, has its good aspects and bad aspects, one of its good aspects is precisely that it is aware of its bad aspects. Like the very fact that an individual could, in the 16th century, condemn his own civilization for its treatment of the Indians and look dispassionately and without prejudice at the situation and say, all people in this world are in some way one, that the human race at some fundamental level is a unity, and that we are all subject to the same moral rules. And for that reason, it is wrong for us to treat these people like garbage, because they too, they also have the faculty of reason that makes them, the same kind of thing we are. So it's wrong for us to treat them this way, and we are bound by the same unchanging principles of justice that anyone else is bound by, so we are in the wrong and we should be blamed. Well, we do this all the time. We talk about, we shouldn't have done this, we shouldn't have done that. But it's not like this was a commonplace in the world. In fact, the Indian tribes themselves were not exactly known for deep moral reflection on their own behavior. To the contrary, Samuel Eliot Morrison, who's a Harvard historian, points out that when you look at the New England tribes, for example, they had the same word for enemy that they had for member of another tribe. Or a member of another tribe, they would also indistinguishably call them the son of the she-dog. Like they had all these incredibly disparaging references. Now, is it likely that in that civilization you will be able to have this kind of dispassionate reflection, moral reflection on your own behavior? Or isn't it more likely that you're going to say, no, my tribe is right and your tribe is wrong because mine is mine and yours is yours and you're stupid and evil and I'm great? So the very fact that the Europeans are able to engage in this type of moral reflection is a reflection of the strength of their civilization. I mean, that's at least something that we could say, that one silver lining amidst this tragedy that did indeed occur is that the crisis of conscience that it provoked among many people at the time is what led to the thinking that yielded the human rights philosophy, that there is a single moral standard that binds us all. That comes not out of the 18th century, just out of nowhere. That really derives from the school of Salamanca that we get so much economics from. They were also thinking about this. They were condemning the monarchs of that day, and it was Suarez who was considered to be the father of natural rights and international law, and Grotius later also had that title. He was a Protestant. But anyway, so that's kind of the way I think about it. All right, let me jump back here. All right, just hang on, guys, just on the entering stuff. I'm going to go back and try and reread things that I may have missed here. Okay. Oh, the Indians did have some diseases. Like the word is that a particularly virulent strain of syphilis was carried back by some of Columbus's men, but they weren't powerful enough to overwhelm the Europeans. Okay. What Freedom Fest is like? I attended. I've spoken at it 2 years in a row. It's all different groups are there, and there are some panels that are great, fascinating, and radical and wonderful, and others that you just can't believe what's going on. I was very well received there, although I remember after I made a sort of disparaging remark about Mitt Romney, which is always gets laughs in all the audiences I speak to, but at Freedom Fest I had a guy come up to me afterward and say, Mitt Romney's a very smart guy. I think he would solve our problems. And I said, well, thank you very much, sir. Glad you could stop by. Okay, let's see. Okay. Oh, good. Okay, so maybe they are fixing the audio. Thanks, Mike. I didn't realize that. Okay. Okay. Oh, and that's really good stuff about immunity and stuff. Thank you guys for... this is really great I feel like you guys have all got some kind of knowledge that I don't have, and so this is beneficial for everybody. That's great. I've never heard of the movie Hawaii, I'm sorry to say. I was just griping on Facebook that I cannot believe there is a remake of the movie Arthur that's coming out, when the Dudley Moore version was absolutely perfect. Dudley Moore and Sir John Gielgud were perfect in those roles. This is an atrocity. Was the guy who came up to you Mitt Romney? That's good. That is good. All right. And Liza Minnelli. I love Liza Minnelli. I'm so, you know, call me a name if you want to, but I like Liza Minnelli, and she was great as Linda in that movie. Let's see. We'll go on for another, like, 8 minutes, and I have to open the window for my next group. Ever been on a yacht? Does he want some cheese? I've memorized that movie, by the way, so I would know all these references. And I loved that Christopher Cross song. And when I was a kid, I remember I couldn't stay up late enough to watch the Grammys to see if he won the best movie song. But we taped it, and then as I was getting ready for school the next morning, I put it on, and he performed the song, and he won. And I was so excited. Awesome books we need to read. Yeah, I'll get to that in a minute, but I want to talk more about Arthur. We gotta get our priorities straight, people. I guess there's so many. I mean, of course, I love the. So he's sitting there in the bathtub. So, anyway, I don't know. I better not do this. I often think fish must get awfully tired of seafood. What are your thoughts, Hobson? Oh, man, that is such a good movie. You've got to see this. If you have not seen this movie, now you can't watch it with kids because there are a couple of dicey references, but that is such a great movie. I mean, Dudley Moore just puts everybody to shame in that role. Don't you hate Harry's wife? Oh, pardon me. Oh, you're a hedge. All right, what else? Let's see. All right, more awesome books. You're making me... Yeah. All right, I already told you about Hoppe. I told you about Robert Nisbet. Let me look behind. I mean, obviously, most of my books are in another room, but maybe I've got a few here. No, these are okay. I wouldn't say they're the greatest books in the history of the world. Let's see. Not really. A 1,000-page book on the American Whig Party. No. Okay. What else? You know, what I would have to do is, I really would just have to walk down my bookshelves and just look. Yeah, I just don't know. Oh, good. Thank you, Lou. That's very helpful. And David, no, I don't have any comment, only because I was gone all weekend and I haven't had time to follow the details of the news because I was putting these slides together today because I didn't use slides when I was in the classroom, so I was doing this just for you guys. Okay. Yeah, Atlas Shrugged could be okay. Gary North wrote a pretty good piece about that. But I think by this, yeah, because I think by the time kids get old enough to be going to the movies regularly, unfortunately, their values are almost always formed already. That really is, so what Gary North says is, it's much more important, if objectivists want to spread their philosophy, it's more important they put together, you know, a homeschool curriculum. So you form the people's minds. Like, that's what you need to do. Okay. Yeah, let's see. Gosh, what is that? Great books. Oh, my gosh. Why am I not able to think of that? I mean, I like Lou Rockwell's stuff because I think his columns are really very insightful. So when he puts them together in books, I think those are worth reading. So The Left, The Right, and The State. It's very thought-provoking. I think there's some interesting stuff in Jeff Tucker's book, Bourbon for Breakfast. Yeah, I mean, that's not a silly book. I mean, there's a lot of good material in there. But I don't know why I'm just drawing a blank. I mean, if you like the Constitution, yeah, Constitution, Smonstitution, but Kevin Gutzman's Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution is a really good book. Creature from Jekyll Island. Do we homeschool? We used to, but now I've got my kids in probably the only private school in the whole country I trust with them. So we don't homeschool, but I certainly, you know, I'm always talking to my eldest daughter about stuff as she's ready to hear it. Okay, let me see. How far back does the Philadelphia banking elite go? Yeah, I only know Robert Morris. I don't know beyond that. That's something that Rothbard would have known. And I never read Witness by Whitaker Chambers, believe it or not. I did read Creature from Jekyll Island, or a good portion of it. I would like to put together a list of history books. I have a whole spiel, I have a whole website project I'm working on for later this year that I think is going to blow people's minds, given what's going to be available on it. It's going to be for homeschoolers, it's going to be for the general public, for anybody who just wants to... I think it will help our side really be equipped with so much knowledge that could be acquired so quickly. That's the goal of this website thing I've got cooking. Okay, let's see. Okay, so... Yeah, I was almost on that Glenn Beck show, but they went with G. Edward Griffin. Okay, let's see. And I tried referring them to Mike in Tokyo Rogers to talk about Japan for their Japan show last week, but it's too dicey to get a satellite from Tokyo for obvious reasons. Let me go back here, though, the Catholic books question. Well, I'll tell you what I do like. There's a multi-volume history of the church. I'm very interested in church history. And my favorite church historian is a Frenchman, and I think it's actually a pen name, Henri Daniel Rops. Daniel, traditional spelling, dash R-O-P-S is his last name, Henri Daniel Rops. And he wrote a multi-volume history of the church. It's long out of print. It was originally written in French. The English translation is so unbelievably elegant that if that is in any way faithful to the original French, then that must be just heavenly. I can't get over how well written it is. But it is so well told, and he is so knowledgeable that, I mean, I read that for pleasure. It's so, so well done. There's some fiction I like. I like Michael O'Brien's Catholic novels. I like his book Eclipse of the Sun. And Father Elijah, those are very good. I mean, those are good books just in their own right. But so that's sort of quick off the top of my head. Okay, have I listened to the Great Courses series? One way to keep up with this website idea and things I'm up to is go to tomwoods.com and sign up for my newsletter. I send out a so-called they call it a newsletter, right? I send out like a little update like once every 9 weeks. It's like you are not going to be bothered by this thing. I always forget that I have it. I forget that I have a mailing list. But I will be sending out a note to everybody who's on that list when it's ready. But this question about the Great Courses series, let's see here. Yeah, I've listened to a few of those. What have I listened to? Years and years ago, back in the 1990s, I used to have to make a long drive once a week. I had to make a long drive from Massachusetts to Connecticut, and I felt like I'm wasting. Even then, I was a stickler about wasting time. I am wasting my time, I thought. So from my local library, I got the Greenberg course on how to listen to and understand great music. I'd taken a course on the symphony as an undergrad, but this went way beyond that. And I listened to basically that whole thing just on these drives. And I thought that was really great, and that allowed me to learn something that's beyond my usual thing. I also listened to both halves of their History of Science thing, and that's really well done. That's I was very, very pleased with that. So I think I've done a little bit, just mainly when I know I have to make long drives. But now that in the age of the Internet, and I've got all this Mises material to listen to. There's never any shortage of stuff to listen to. I could listen to Scott Horton podcasts. I haven't had to resort to that. They say I've got an embarrassment of riches, really, things to listen to. But really, what I want to do is, if you like that great courses, that you know, the teaching company, that's basically what my website's going to be. Except my website will be like, you can get like 8 courses for the price of 1 course from them. But it won't be like Mises Academy. It won't be this neat interaction that we have live, unfortunately. I won't be able to reproduce that. But still, I'll be able to say, look, you know, here's your whole American history from beginning to end. Here's your whole Western civilization from beginning to end. Here's a Civil War course. Here's whatever. We'll just go down, you know, boom, boom, boom. And I'm just going to keep on adding them and adding them and adding them and adding them and adding them. And it's going to be me teaching it and a few other people I trust. So, you know, so it'll be mainly focused on history, because that's, you know, I'm trying to follow Gary North's advice. You know, just do, you know, work in that area where you would be the hardest to replace. That's how he puts it. Not where you're indispensable. Nobody's really indispensable. Where would you be the hardest to replace? So I want to really focus on getting historical information out there. Okay. I've never heard of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Oh, is that what you're suggesting that I do? Or is there such a thing? Is it a podcast? Interesting. Yeah, it's antiwar.com/radio for Scott Horton. Okay. All right, listen, I'm going to have to get going because strictly speaking, the thing about Harvard is you actually have to declare your major by the end of freshman year, which is pretty early. They call it a concentration. So I went into, so strictly speaking, my concentration was always history. As soon as I had to declare it, it was history. But my intent going into that was math or applied math. And then I switched it, I considered economics, and then I instead did history. Okay, and I like Will Durant, too. I mean, he and his wife read an awful lot. Okay, all right, thank you, everybody. Next time, it's a whirlwind tour. We got a whole lot to talk about next time. So thank you very much. I appreciate all the good questions and interactions and everything. Very nice. You email me, of course, about speaking engagements, sure. Okay. All right. Thank you, everybody. Good night.